people wear a feminist t-shirt, like I'm a feminist kind of t-shirt, and thinking that that is enough. And some of that is validating for sure, right? But I also find that for a lot of people, the buck kind of stops there. And that's the problem, because they're not understanding the problematic history that has brought feminism to where it is today, and also the problematic history in terms of its intersection with white supremacy.
This is Unladylike. I'm Kristen. And Unladies, wow, did I feel so seen in that moment you just heard from today's guest, Kim Hong-wen, talking about, we'll call it t-shirt feminism. You know, we're on a video call together. In that moment, I realized that I was wearing a feminist t-shirt. I was wearing my abortion is okay t-shirt. And I did suddenly feel self-conscious, but I will say that I really felt like I dodged a bullet by not bringing my Nasty Woman coffee mug with me to the interview. And that would have also just been a hat on a hat, right? But listen to me, I'm being rude. Before we go any further, I must introduce today's guest, Kim Hong-wen. Kim is an associate professor of communication arts and gender and social justice at University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. Hello, Canadian Unladies. Kim's research and teaching focuses on the intersections of race and gender in the neoliberal era. Her new book that we are talking all about today is called Mean Girl Feminism: How White Feminists Gaslight, Gatekeep, and Girl Boss. For anyone wondering why a couple weeks ago we did an episode of Unladylike on the cool mom, now we're talking mean girl feminism. Is Tina Fey dark money propping up Unladylike? No, absolutely not. It is purely coincidence, but mean girls, yes, like they are a reference in the book, because what Kim does and does so well is she uses pop culture and public figures to articulate a profound and necessary critique of mainstream feminism. How do you define mean girl feminism?
I think that we know that women are often stereotyped or supposed to be nice. And I think that with the onset of feminism, white women have taken up meanness, and it is presented as if it were this feminist strategy of breaking, overturning stereotypes. And that in and of itself is a way of combating patriarchal power. And so that is what I'm calling mean girl feminism. This idea that we need to be bitchy, we need to be sassy. And this is a way of sort of performing feminism. And I think that white feminism in particular has celebrated this kind of image of what a feminist is supposed to be. And this image is also quite Western. The idea that you need to be super articulate, you need to be super argumentative and eloquent in order to express an idea. And I want to see myself in some kind of way as a mean girl feminist in this kind of light. And I do think I'm kind of a recovering mean girl feminist myself, wanting to resist systems of oppression, including patriarchal power, but also living with this expectation that feminist protest means basically being mean people. So to this end, I wanted to explore how feminism has kind of lost where harm comes from, because it's appropriating the kinds of anger that have been typically associated with racialized women. The snappy Black woman, the cold dragon lady, the loud Latina, the angry Indigenous woman. And that's reinforcing the stereotypes associated with racialized women. And that's a problem that I'm really interested in making visible and exposing.
And maybe this is an obvious question to ask, but why is it a problem?
I think much feminist scholarship has been about this post-feminist moment where everything we see is not feminist enough. And I think that this negativity is part of this meanness. It is part of this mean girl feminism that suggests that everything hinges on gender. And so the kind of anger that we might see from racialized women is a kind of anger that is not being validated by feminism itself because it's not about gender. And so because everything hinges on gender, mean girl feminism suggests that feminist organizing and advocacy doesn't seem to exist. And so what we have then is white women attacking other women for not being feminist enough. And ultimately, what this does is it polices the boundaries of femininity. And there's a lot of racialized history that shows that this keeps racialized women oppressed and out of the conversation of feminism. And in my view, and the feminist scholarship that I really wanted to amplify, like bell hooks, talk about how feminism is a social movement. Not this sort of like firmed up static identity that is to be performed by some people and not by others. I'm not saying that it's not futile to practice feminist values in our lives. I think that's a very important project and very important effort. But I think it's a journey. It's a process. It's not this am or am not. And there's a bit of obsession around what feminist identity is and what it looks like. And I think that this is where mean girl feminism is emerging. And so in my view, feminism isn't something that happens in solitude. It isn't something that happens in friendship even. It happens in collectives. It happens in groups. It happens en masse.
Talk to me a little bit about the distinction, especially in the context of white women and white feminism, this distinction between like meanness and anger.
So meanness is, I think, not necessarily tied to this project of liberation. And so I think that this is where the opening of microaggressions happens, versus anger is very much directed at, we need collective liberation. We need to be talking about the sources of oppression in our lives and how they intersect as well. And so for me, that's the difference between meanness and anger. And another sort of maybe useful term to distinguish here is also rage, right? Mm. I am particularly moved by the research around white rage and how ultimately what the source of white rage is about how white people are upset at the fact that, you know, that they have to deal with a multicultural society, that they have to deal now with other sources of difference other than themselves.
And before we get more kind of deeper into all of these layers, there are kind of four lead characters of mean girl feminism that very helpfully illustrate all of this. And I was wondering if you could just sort of quickly introduce listeners to these characters, starting with the white-splaining white lady of liberal reason.
Yeah. So the white-splaining white lady of liberal reason uses her knowledge of order, law, and rules to tell marginalized people to be patient, to be kind, to expect that justice will eventually happen. And this can appear in conversations that involve white ladies telling marginalized peoples how things work, telling them that they shouldn't expect that their efforts to be successful because it doesn't work with white culture.
Girl boss, a self-promotional equity lady.
Yes, and this white feminist talks about feminism for her own benefit or her brand and not much else. So the girl boss takes charge oftentimes by herself or with her best friend or maybe even with her husband, but not in efforts to bring a qualified team or collective on board into the conversation. And so that's the girl boss.
Karen with illegible rage.
In my view, the Karen figure who wants to speak with a manager is not that different from the Karen figure who phones the police officer. She commands a presence and wants her authority to be acknowledged. And by virtue of that is violating the norms of white femininity, right? By speaking her mind. But in so many ways, we have recognized through seeing how this plays out in the public that it harms racialized folks and it harms many other kinds of marginalized peoples.
And I thought you made such an interesting observation with this Karen figure that it's not so much that she's angry, she's mean.
Yeah, she's like the white lady of liberal reason, right? But she's mobilizing quite explicitly that meanness. And in her mind, she's probably thinking that she's mobilizing anger, right? And that she is following rules and getting people to abide by rules for this sort of like collective justice. But it's clearly not a liberatory project.
And then finally, we have the power couple wife with the resting bitch face.
Yes. So the power couple wife with RBF is the white feminist who accepts toxic masculinity as part of the price of being visible and being given opportunities. So this often involves being married to someone who has problematic sexual relations with people in the workplace or someone who has a history of sexual predations. And when a white woman stands by her man, it can serve as a way of gaslighting the violence in which he's being accused of.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And ladies, most of us have probably had tiny little crushes on weird stuff. I mean, I'm not talking weird as in I'm attracted to toxic narcissists weird. I'm talking about someone's uneven earlobes or the way that a person separates their peas from carrots. Or maybe it's just a specific kink that you can't get out of your head. So if you're looking for that person on a dating app and are not really sure how to ask, Fleur is the sex-positive dating app that prioritizes women's desires. There are no forbidden fantasies, only mandatory respect and consent. Fleur also features a safe mode for women, which prevents unwanted content, such as explicit images, when a woman is not ready to take things to the next level. There's also a two-step verification and moderation for all users, creating a safe space for community where there's no room for offense, judgment, or scams. So download Fleur app, where desires come to life. Is there a difference at all between mean girl feminism and white feminism?
Yes and no. I wanted to talk about mean girl feminism because I think that a lot of the emerging feminisms that feminists are talking about, in particular white feminists who are trying to theorize feminism, are ultimately creating other forms of white feminism so that they can gatekeep the terms of feminism itself. And I think that when a lot of white feminists are talking about feminism, they're not thinking about how their feminism is racialized. So let's take, for example, a comparison for the sake of argument. There are a range of Black feminisms, right? Womanism, ratchet feminism, hip-hop feminism, crunk feminism, hashtag Me Too feminism. All of these Black feminisms, they offer a way in, right? They offer a way of understanding how gender and other forms of oppression impact daily life. And ultimately, they're aimed at expanding how feminism can be more inclusive and better address conditions of inequality and oppression. In contrast, when we look at white feminisms, they're often talking about how this or that feminism is not it. Mm. Right? So instead of building coalitions, white feminism is hyper-focusing on performativity in order to police the boundaries of what is appropriate feminist politics. So we have all of these various feminisms that are ultimately not talking about how hashtag feminism is so white, right? So we have first wave feminism, second wave feminism, neoliberal feminism, post-feminism, all of these terms ultimately to not name how white feminism is the problem, how white women, because of their whiteness, because of their alignment with white men, because their commitments to or complicity with white supremacy are the problem. And so I think these terms are emerging as ways of ultimately not reflecting and not thinking about how interpretive frameworks are white. And, you know, I think that post-feminism or neoliberal feminism, I would say that these are very much forms of feminism. And they may be basic. They may be elementary. They might be bad takes. But I think that the direction of white feminist scholarship has aimed to drive its attachment to gender just a little harder around this critique around post-feminism and neoliberal feminism and all these other feminisms in order to show how the world's inequalities can be reduced to gender. And so I very much want to talk about mean girl feminism because I want white feminism to move in a different direction. I wanted to talk about and think hard about what does it mean to be in coalition? What does it mean to break free from this single axis notion of oppression? And so that they are not continuing this harm of directing meanness towards other marginalized peoples.
And talk to me a little bit about how the construct and colonial history of white womanhood feeds so much into this, of that intersection of white womanhood and meanness.
So you're probably familiar with tone policing, which is the idea of dismissing an argument because it's angry or emotional in tone, when really the dismissal amounts to disliking the content of the argument. And in coming up with mean girl feminism, I want to explore this tone performing, this idea of focusing on the tone of the argument, the performance of the argument, as if that is the argument itself, being sassy, being bitchy, being ironic, sarcastic, all of these as ways of becoming a feminist rather than actually doing the feminism or putting feminism into practice to improving the lives of all. So instead of white women in yesteryear who were being nice while racist, now they're just being mean while racist and thinking that they're being radical, that they're being inventive, on trend, different, and feminist. And so that, I think, is that relationship between the colonial notion of white womanhood and where we see it being played out today.
Well, and this is also bringing to mind as well, like, I think you describe it in the book as almost like this fetishizing of gender and the category of woman. When I hear that, I also think of the group of transphobic white feminists who have really, you know, found their angry voices, their mean voices in recent years.
Yes. Yes. And they are dialing hard on that. And you can just tell immediately based on those conversations that it is about, right, protecting the boundary of femininity. And that is being considered vital in order to create a certain kind of advocacy around what feminism is as well.
Mean Girl Feminism, as I was reading it, it was also taking me back to 2020. During the Black Lives Matter protests, there's also what has been described as like racial reckonings within the feminist movement, within large organizations like Planned Parenthood. Does Mean Girl Feminism to you look any different today since that reckoning, I'm going to say allegedly, happened? Does it look any different to you today in our landscape of post-Dobbs, post-girl boss?
This is a great question. And I would say, you said allegedly, and I'm going to follow with that. Yes. No, not really. And I think this is because the people who have been named as problematic or blamed for the problems probably have been removed. And I don't think it's because they were mean girl feminists per se, but because they were seen as problematic individuals with problematic behavior. Individualize a problem, contain it. And if, you know, you mentioned some of these organizations as dealing with this racial reckoning and that some of them may have been shuttered, right? Like The Wing, for example. These brands and organizations might, in response, sort of now, if they haven't been shuttered, right, that they might may have in response now included more racialized people, but they're not rethinking the terms of the organization, or they're not being held accountable for their past actions. And I invite people to read some other wonderful books on white feminism, like Jesse Daniels in Nice White Ladies talks about The Wing, and Kyla Schuler in The Trouble with White Women talks about Planned Parenthood and Margaret Sanger's white feminism. But I think that these and other feminist-affiliated organizations do the same kinds of problems that racialized women, queer, trans, disabled folks, working class have been saying about feminism, which is that feminism can be a mean girl clique that keeps marginalized people out, and that a feminist-affiliated organization can take sort of that girl squad as like this kind of icon or image to which they strive, when really it might just as well be a clique of friends who further the careers and influence and wealth of very well-placed people in society. So it looks like solidarity. It looks like collective organizing. It looks like a social movement is possibly happening, but it really isn't.
And it then becomes so telling if we just take the case of Planned Parenthood and large reproductive rights organizations that have been very implicated in their overwhelming whiteness, especially once the Dobbs decision comes down and there are all of these brand new abortion restrictions that are passing. What I observed was a white feminist response from that of like, okay, there's really no time to critique what we are doing here because, sorry, you know, abortion's not legal anymore. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yep. We need to focus on this one issue. We can't be distracted or the goal is not going to be achieved, right? Yeah. Yep. That's the mean girl feminism happening.
And it's like if someone then does call something out or call something in, they will probably just be branded as a troublemaker, I would imagine.
Yes, a troublemaker or difficult to work with or a big complainer. And I think because of that, you know, Sarah Ahmed wrote a book called Complaint, which is trying to sort of illustrate how this is a real problem in institutional politics that bring in marginalized people and then shun them, outcast them, and prevent them ultimately from doing the work that they're hired to do.
And I also want to ask about the other side of this meanness coin, maybe. You talk about feminist civility. So what is feminist civility and how does it also function in this mean girl feminism ecosystem?
Yeah, feminist civility, in my view, is this expectation that when white women are being sassy or bitchy or ironic or sarcastic, that is just part of the feminist labor. And I wanted to provide further exploration and rethinking about whether or not this is actually part of our feminist work.
The knee-jerk white feminist response that I can hear to this is, okay, but women are dying out here because they can't access abortions. And Andrew Tate has brainwashed a whole generation of boys. Misogyny and sexism are real. I'm underpaid. It's just going down the litany of gender gaps, let's say. How would you respond to that? But what about?
I think even in the light sort of flippant way of addressing it as sort of like the white woman whining, right, sort of creates this sort of image of it's not that serious, right? Let's just shake her a little bit. I think that your question is very serious. We're living in a very trying, difficult time. And I also think that where white women's advocacy on those very issues could be stronger, deeper, go farther, mobilize harder, would involve recognizing those issues as intersectional ones. And so for me, that would be where I find people who are doing sort of social justice work and organizing, they stay a little bit longer, right? And find that they are able to engage with more allies, are able to create larger and more meaningful coalitions because they are knowledgeable about how the issue affects not just one particular marginalized group, but multiple marginalized groups. And so that would be where I would encourage people to be thinking about when they're thinking about, you know, post-Dobbs and all of that. post-Dobbs, for example, is incredibly impactful on, you know, working class racialized women, just as much as it would be for a white woman who is trying to, you know, create a family. And so intersectionality would be an important way of rethinking feminism. And that's something that, you know, the third wave has been talking about for so long. One of my favorite comedians, Michelle Wolf, who recently came out with a new stand-up special, It's Great to Be Here. I don't know if you've seen it, but I highly recommend it. And she's a white woman comedian. And she puts the struggle this way. Like, she says, hearing how hard the struggle is for other people is really hard for white women, that they need a social media break. And I think that she does a great job of recognizing that she can't fetishize gender oppression because it will only get her but so far, and that she really needs to be aware of how oppressions are intersecting. And so I also, you know, I hear the struggle a lot about how do you negotiate your privilege versus aspects of your marginalized identity? And, you know, this is something that we talk about with students all the time. And I think that it's really important that we continue to fight the fight, right? And don't really think twice about, right? Am I the center of that fight? And so that means that sometimes we have to work with people we don't like. You know, that means that we have to deal with issues that may not impact us directly, but rather indirectly. But that is part of the work of collective struggle. And I think that when we recognize that, then intersectional feminism isn't this, you know, mean girl clique, right? But rather it is this collective struggle. It is this social movement. And this is the question that bell hooks raises around creating feminism for everybody. This is where I want to begin our conversation. So how can we make feminism for everybody, not just for the mean girl clique?
And that gets to paraphrase your observation in the book, if a future decolonial feminism might not be recognizable as feminism at all, what might it look like instead?
This, I think, is an important question. Recently, I was working on an abstract for a conference, and the question of whether to put the word feminism in there was debated. And I think that is the direction in which I think we need to be talking about, right? That we may not be uttering the word feminism, even though our work is feminist. And I think that when feminism engages in this, who or what is feminism, I think that's the wrong question. Because I think that the question is, how can we make a different world? How can we create a world that is more just for all? How can we make a better world? What would that world look like? And I think that the question of, do we need to utter the word feminism as part of that, doesn't necessarily need to be the first question. It can be part of the conversation for sure, but I don't think it necessarily needs to be the first question.
But if I'm not advertising that I myself am a feminist, Kim, how are people going to know that, like, I'm a good person?
Yeah, I know. And I think, Kristen, you've really hit the nail on the head. It's wanting to show that we are good people. And can we do that without that label? Can we do feminist work without the stereotypical or maybe non-stereotypical characteristics of, you know, feminist performativity? And I think that's a hard question for us to answer now.
Thank you so much to Kim Hong Nguyen. You can get her book, Mean Girl Feminism, How White Feminists Gaslight, Gatekeep, and Girl Boss, at all of the bookstore places. Pick it up, really. I think that it would be excellent book club fodder. As always, I would love to hear what y'all think about this episode. If this conversation really sparked anything for you, you can send voice memos or emails to hello@unladylike.co. You can also DM me on Instagram @unladylikemedia. If you want to really support the show or just get more great episodes, then you need to come on over to the Unladies Room. That is the Patreon. Again, Tina Fey, not secretly funding this podcast. Patreon.com/unladylikemedia is where you can go, or just search Unladylike Media in your Patreon app. And thank you. You can follow Unladylike on Instagram and TikTok @unladylikemedia. Unladylike is an Unladylike Media production, executive produced, written, edited, and hosted by me, Kristen Conger. Engineering is by Amita Ganatra. Our music is by Flamingo Shadow, Amit May Cohen, and Sarah Tudson. Until next week. I do have one more question for you, though, Kim.
Okay.
What is the most unladylike thing about you?
The most unladylike thing about me, and I think that my family would really appreciate that I be public about this, is that I burp all the time. I burp loudly, unequivocally, without saying excuse me, and it drives my family up the wall. Yes.